happy Ides of March. It's March 15, 2016. Welcome to the Crystal Silence League Hour. I am, as always, your humble host, the Reverend John St. Germain. And tonight we're continuing our discussion of the Eightfold Noble Path of the Buddha. We've covered the Four Noble Truths, but we'll be revisiting them often as they are integrated into the teachings of the Buddha, kind of like that loose thread is integrated into that ugly sweater you like to wear. let's jump right into that after a brief musical interlude. We are on episode 51 of this, which means that's a full year of Crystal Silence League Hour shows. We've been on there longer than a year, though, because, you know, we do reruns and things like that. So thanks for the longevity. Every morning I wake up and I'm still alive. I thank the forces and the good spirits and all the gods that beam their benevolent face down upon me. So do come back in just a minute with your crystal balls in hand, and we will return. John St. Germain here, your host, broadcasting as always from the beautiful Chateau St. Germain in Knoxville, Tennessee, home of many things. Did you know that Rachmaninoff and Hank Williams and a few other people did their last concert here? It's a great place to end a career if you were thinking about doing that. Our stone of the evening is Fuchsite, and you can see a piece of it on our slideshow, as always, a beautiful green stone that resonates to the heart chakra. And it's a healing stone. Some people call it the healing stone. You know, there's a lot of stones that people call the healing stone. I can rattle off about 10 of them right now. But they do say if you are a healer, you should get a reasonably good-sized piece of this and keep it around. Because if you're a professional healer, it's very useful to have if you're seeing clients, because healers often latch on to their clients. You'll project your own emotions onto your clients, and this is a good way, Fuchsite is a good way to erect a barrier between your own emotions and your clients. It helps you with objectivity. And also, there's a lot of times when our own compassion is our worst enemy. You'll have clients who want you to do free work, or you book a 30-minute session and they want to go an hour, and Fuchsite is very good for you not doing that. It will erect a buffer between your compassion and the tendency for some people to want to take advantage of that compassion. Because often we see ourselves in our client, and we want to self-heal by healing through our clients. And, you know, that is an issue. That is an issue. Fuchsite is also very good for connecting with nature spirits and beings that are known as devas in Buddhist countries. Devas are spirits that live in trees and foliage. It's not believed that trees have their own spirits, but it is believed that spirits live in trees. They're called tree devas. And not everyone knows the presence of these beings, but in many Buddhist countries, you'll ask a tree's permission before you'll cut it down or even pick fruit from it. And the reason is you don't want to anger the tree devas. They'll cause bad luck. And plus, it's just considered rude. So if you keep your trees and bushes healthy and cared for, these spirits will tend to move into your garden and into your trees, and you can bring sick trees back to life this way. And Fushat can help you communicate with these spirits. There's a number of stones you can do. The Seraphonite, which is an angel stone, can also help you communicate with these spiritual beings. So you can invite these spirits to live in your garden, tell them it's very safe to live there, and these spirits will move into your trees and your foliage and bring you fortune and luck and even wealth. So that's Fushat. Fushat is a very handy stone to have around the area. Not a cheap stone, but not terribly expensive either. The Crystal Silence League, as those of you who may not know, was founded around 1917 by Claude Alexander Conlon for the purpose of projecting and disseminating positive prayer and affirmation to all those in need. And this was done through the agency of Crystal Balls. And Mr. Conlon taught the four branches of crystal gazing, which we also teach. We have a couple of books you can get, or if you buy a crystal from us, you can also get one of these books, Lessons in Crystal Gazing. And we teach them in the archives of our show. You can go back, and the four branches are taught thoroughly, and we will be revisiting them again many times. And we also have the Crystal Silence League online, because when Mr. Conlon passed into the silence himself in 1954, the Crystal Silence League went with him, along with many of his wonderful publications that he produced during his lifetime. And so the Missionary Independent Spiritual Church brought it back online. You can go to www.crystalsilenceleague.org, that's org, O-R-G, where you'll find the Crystal Silence League, and where you can post prayers online. Mr. Conlon had people mail them in the letters and postcards, and he got hundreds a week, I believe, as we get hundreds a week. And I'm not exaggerating. We do get literally hundreds of prayers a week. And it's been my custom to read these aloud on the air and invite you to pray. I don't read hundreds of them. I just read about 20 of them each week, a selection. And I pick them at random. I really do. I just go through and pick them at random and print them out. I don't even read them until the first time I read them is on the air. So I don't know what to expect from some of these prayers. We have people praying for everything from sick relatives to get a new stereo for their car. I'm serious. So please join me in prayer for the following people. And I only identify them by prayer ID. Names are never announced on the air or on our website. Prayer ID number 48744, who is praying to get finances in order and money for the medicines needed for medicines and for a decent living situation. Prayer ID number 48743 is thanking everyone for previous prayer requests and needs a good job so she can get out of a job she doesn't enjoy and get into a much better job that's closer to her heart. Prayer ID number 48742 prays that she and her cat can find a better place to live. I'm always sympathetic toward people who are trying to help their animals. Prayer ID number 48741 wants to hotfoot a woman causing chaos in her life. Hotfoot, for those of you who don't know, is a root work spell to get someone to move, to go away. Prayer ID number 48740, I hope she's successful in that, is reconciliation, wants to get back with the person with whom she has broken up with, a reconciliation for a broken love affair, and hopes the other person realizes how much she loves him. Prayer ID number 48739 prays for forgiveness for all of her sins and wants and says she's trying to get back on her feet and prays for the strength to make her life better again. Prayer ID number 48738 prays that there are good spirits clearing her of all black magic. She's praying for cleansing and lifting of hexes, it looks like. Prayer ID number 48737 prays that her future husband be sent to her very soon. Handsome, compatible, fun-loving, giving, passionate, loyal, and a good heart, and more. I hope that comes true for you. prayer ID number 48736. Prays for protection for her and her kids, and that she and her husband's relationship grows loving and fulfilling. Prayer ID number 48735. Prays that her next door neighbor will stop their constant noise. I wonder if my wife sent this in, because we have that problem. Drilling, hammering, parties, inside and out. Yeah, this definitely sounds like our neighbors. Inside and outside, and that they'll leave them in peace, and that they get new neighbors who are quiet and decent and not ones who do this day and night. Can I amend ourselves to that prayer, too? I'm going to send this in, too. I hope you get better neighbors. I really do, and I hope we get better neighbors. It sounds like our neighbors. Prayer ID number 48734. Prays for forgiveness for his or her stupidity this morning, and prays for guidance. Prayer ID number 48733. Prays for healing with her husband, Kay. I won't go into details about this. It's a very personal problem. But may the healing take place. And prayer ID number 48732. Prays that her children be close to her and to each other. And prayer ID number 48731 is praying for mercy and salvation. And we have prayer ID number 48730, prays to be freed from anxiety and to be filled with confidence and happiness. And we have prayer ID number 48729, prays for help for someone whose initial is WDG. Prayer ID number 48728 has been ambushed by coworkers and prays for protection from the evil plans of their coworkers. Prayer ID number 48727 prays for love to enter her life, and that a particular person whose initial is C be reunited with her. Then prayer ID number 48726 wants F to see how his actions have hurt the petitioner, and needs assistance in F understanding how his actions continue to hurt the petitioner, and wants communication to open up between them. And our last prayer, prayer ID number 48725, prays to be released of his or her anger, because that anger is poisoning his or her spirit, and prays to be freed from her anger, his or her anger. May all these people find peace, and may their prayers be answered, and let's take a moment of silence for all those in need of comfort and healing. Tonight, of course, is the eight noble truths of the eightfold noble path of the Buddha. I'm determined to talk about the fourfold noble truths, aren't I? But tonight we are talking about continuing our discussion of the eightfold noble path of the Buddha, and we were talking last week about right intention and how wrong intention is supplanted by good intention, and we were talking about the intention of goodwill and how the intention of goodwill opposes the intention of ill will, which are thoughts governed by anger and aversion. And just as in the case of a desire, there are two ineffective ways of handling ill will. One is to give in to it, to express the aversion that you feel, the anger and aversion that you feel by either bodily or verbal action. This approach releases the tension, and it helps drive the anger out of your system, but it also opens you up to lots of danger. It breeds resentment. It creates more ill will. It can lead to retaliation, either verbal or physical. It can create enemies. It ruins relationships, and it generates the fruits of unwholesome karma. And in the end, the ill will does not leave the system, after all, we find, but it's just driven down to a deeper level, plus it sows the seed for more. And it also conditions the thoughts to more ill will. But the other approach, repression, also fails to quench the destructive force of ill will. It just turns the force around and pushes it inward, where it becomes depression, self-contempt, or a tendency for irrational outbursts of violence over the least provocation. So the remedy that the Buddha recommends to counteract ill will, especially when the object of this ill will is another person, which it most usually is a quality that we visited before, which is known as metta. Metta, of course, is loving kindness. And it's been described as the love that a mother would feel for her only child. Now, metta is derived from a Pali word which means friend, but it signifies much more than that. It's usually translated as loving kindness, which best captures the intention of metta. It's a intense feeling of non-selfish love for other beings that is radiated outwards as a sincere concern for their well-being and happiness. Now, imagine that you're doing this for someone for whom you feel ill will. It's not an easy thing to do. It's a selfless loving kindness. It means that you're doing this not for benefit for yourself, but as a gift you give to others. And it's not a sentimental goodwill. It's not that sappy goodwill, nor is it a response to a divine command. It's not like there's a, you know, thou shalt love thy neighbor. This has to become a deep and constant inner feeling that is cultivated, which is a spontaneous warmth that you constantly radiate rather than that you feel it by a sense of obligation, that you have to do it. And at its peak, metta rises to what is known as a Brahma-Vihara, which is one of the paramitas, or divine dwelling. Metta is one of the Brahma-Vihara is one of the divine dwellings, and we discussed those one time. There's metta, equanimity, and several others, which is a total, it's an abode. You live there, a divine dwelling, a way of being centered on this radiant wish for the welfare of all living and sentient beings. And the kind of affection and love and friendship implied by metta is separate from sensual love, and it's separate from the love involved in personal affection. This is not the love you feel for, you know, your best friend or your lover. Sensual love is a form of craving. It's necessarily self-directed because there's pleasure involved. And the love you, and second, personal affection still includes a degree of attachment. You know, we love a person because that person gives us pleasure. You know, we take pleasure in seeing them. This person belongs in a group, you know, in a circle. It's our family, our circle of friends, and they reinforce our self-image. They're my friend, you know, my family. And only rarely does that feeling of affection transcend all traces of ego reference. I mean, can you see that? My friend, my family, my son, my mother. And even then, it's very limited in scope. That affection is limited in scope. That type of affection only applies to a certain person or group while excluding others. By necessity, it does. By definition, it does. The love involved in metta is contrasted to this, does not hinge on a particular relations to particular people. It's selfless. It does not ever reference self or ego. The reference point of self is utterly erased. We are concerned only with suffusing others with a mind that lives and dwells in loving kindness. This is what metta is, which ideally is to be cultivated into a universal state extended to all living beings without discrimination, without reservation, without hesitation. All living beings, even those for whom we have every reason to feel aversion and ill will. And this is where we're going to stumble, because all you have to do is look on Facebook, the internet, television, and you're going to go, ooh, I hate that person. Oh my God, he makes me mad. Oh, I can't stand that person. These are the thoughts that we are talking about. These are the thoughts of ill will and aversion that delude and taint and poison the mind, that we have to knock out, like the carpenter knocks out the rotted peg with a new peg. And if your mind is shying from those thoughts and saying, but they are hateful, it's justified anger, it's justified ill will, then you ain't getting it. You just ain't getting it. There is no justified anger. There is no justified ill will. That's why the world is on fire, because people think they have a right to be mad. They have a right to hate. They have a right to this. No. No. I'm telling you, no. And I'm telling you, no, because the Buddha said no. The Buddha said the world is sick, and the world is on fire, and the world is dying. And it's because people think they have a right to be mad. People think they have a right to ill will, and it poisons the mind. Substitute ill will with metta. So these spontaneous feelings of thought, the word for this type of thought is bhavana, B-H-A-V-A-N-A, bhavana. And you're going to hear bhavana mentioned quite a bit. Bhavana is a stream of consciousness. So metta bhavana is the meditation on loving kindness. And it is one of the most important kinds of meditation. The Metta Sutta, which I have read before, begins with developing loving-kindness toward yourself, toward oneself. And that seems counterintuitive. It seems like you're focusing on yourself and being selfish, but you're not. You have to love yourself first before you can love others. If you're tainted with self-hate, with contempt, with self-loathing, you can never do this type of love for someone else. So it's suggested that one take oneself as the very first object of metta, because true loving-kindness for others is only possible when you're able to feel genuine loving-kindness for yourself. And this is not, again, sentimental love, narcissistic love. This is, remember what metta is. It is the sincere wish for well-being and happiness for all beings. And you start with yourself, and then you project it outward. We've done that on this very show. And when this metta is directed inward toward yourself, it will erase and dissolve and melt down the hardest crust, the most bitter emotions that were spawned by those negative attitudes, and it will allow kindness and sympathy to be cultivated and radiate outward. I've seen miracles in this nature. So once you've learned to kindle the smallest spark of metta toward yourself, the next step is to extend it to others. And oh yes, this takes practice. Oh my goodness, it takes practice. And I will tell you that the Metta Karuna Sutta is probably one of the most beautiful pieces of writings in the Buddhist literature. I remember when I first came across it, my heart broke. I remember reading it, and first I heard it chanted. I heard it chanted in Pali, and I said, "What is this? It's lovely." And in Pali, the first verse is a Karanaya Mata Kasulena Yanta Santam Padam Abhi Samika Sakyo Ujaka Sonjuhaka Savako Kasa Muda Anatimani. And I said, that's lovely. And what is it? And then I heard it in English. And I'll read it to you. And every day for years, this is how I started my day, by meditating on this. And this is the Metta Karuna Sutta, which is what you meditate on when you're doing metta meditation. And this is the Buddha's words on loving kindness. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud and demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove, wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short, or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and yet to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upward to the skies and downward to the depths, outward and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will, whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness. One should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Oh, what a lovely thing. What a lovely thing. And cultivating this state of metta, this state of loving-kindness, frees us from this delusion that we're separate from anyone else. Because, you know, as others are, we are. And this methodical radiation of metta is practiced first by directing it to us, to ourselves. And once you learn to kindle this, you radiate it outward to others, and we see it in ourselves, and we can immediately understand that all living beings share the same basic wish. All want to be well, happy, and secure. And to develop metta towards others, what is to be done is to imagine the same wish for happiness in everyone else. And we use our own desire for happiness and freedom from anxiety and freedom from suffering, and experience this desire as the basic urge of every sentient being, the biggest and the smallest, and then come back to our own position and extend to them the wish that they may achieve the ultimate object of every living being, that they may be well and happy. And this methodical radiation of metta is practiced first by directing metta to individuals representing certain groups. And these groups are, this is a technique you learn, are set in order of progressive remoteness from yourself. It begins with a dear person, someone dear to you, such as your parent or teacher. Then you might move on to a friend, then to a neutral person, and then finally to a hostile person. You're not going to start out with someone that's hostile. That's very difficult. Though these types are defined by their relation to yourself, you might think, well, this doesn't remove me from the picture. The love, though, to be developed is not based on that relation, but on each person's common desire for happiness and freedom from suffering. It's not defined by their relation to you. It's defined by the universal, selfless desire for happiness. So with each individual, one has to bring his or her image into focus and radiate the thought, may he or she be well, may he or she be happy, may he or she be peaceful, may he or she be freed from suffering. And then only when you succeed in generating a warm feeling of goodwill and kindness toward these people should one turn to the next, each person turn to the next. And when you gain proficiency with individuals, then you can work with larger units. You can try developing metta toward all your friends, all neutral people, all hostile people. Then metta can be widened into directions. You can suffuse it to the east. You can suffuse it to the south. You can suffuse it to the north, above and below. Then it can be extended to all beings without distinction. And in the end, one suffuses the entire world with a mind of loving kindness, vast, sublime, immeasurable, without enmity, without aversion. And you know what? When you can do that, then you're ready for crystal ball work to take in the entire world. And you see, these methods were very, very old. So we move to the intention of harmlessness, which is the next part of right intention, is karuna, thought guided by compassion. Compassion is karuna, and it too is a sublime abode. And so karuna is aroused to oppose the idea of cruel and violent thoughts. So compassion supplies the complement to loving kindness. In fact, metta karuna is often said together, metta dash karuna. So whereas loving kindness has the characteristic of wishing the happiness and welfare of others, compassion has the characteristic of wishing that others be free from suffering. And that is the definition in Buddhism of compassion, the wish that others be free from suffering. And this wish is extended without limits to all living and sentient beings. And just like metta, compassion is cultivated by entering into the subjective view of others, by sharing their interior state in a deep and total way. And it will arise in you when you consider that all beings, just like ourselves, wish to be free from suffering. Yet, despite this wish to be free from suffering, we all continue to be harassed by pain and fear and sorrow and grief and all the other forms of dukkha, the dukkha which permeates all of the world. So to develop compassion is a meditative exercise. It's most effective to start with somebody who's actually undergoing visible suffering, since this provides a natural object for compassion. Now, compassion is not sentimentality, and it's not aversion. And these are often mistaken for compassion. And what I mean by that is, oh, I can't stand to see fill-in-the-blank suffering. That's aversion. And it's often complemented with sentimentality. And what I'm about to say may shock you. I can't stand to see animals suffer. I can't stand to see children suffer. That is aversion mixed with sentimentality. Because in samsara, in this world, if you step back and look at it objectively, why should age or race or genus have anything to do with suffering? Why should you be freed from the fruits of karma based on age or genus or cuteness? this is, remember, the world is unsatisfactory, regardless of who you are, what your age is. We are all subject to the unsatisfactoriness. This is why the Buddha said life is inextricably linked with suffering. And we cannot be you know, all we're going to do is create more suffering in ourselves when we mix, when we confuse ourselves, when we confuse compassion with aversion and with sentimentality. I too suffer when I do that, when, you know, we see children, we see animals undergoing sickness and pain. There does seem to be a more bitter tendency in that. But see, we've conditioned ourselves to do that. And what we must do is feel universal compassion for everyone that's suffering. And the suffering is universal. It's universal. If you're in this world, you're suffering. And so compassion is the universal wish for all creatures, all sentient beings, to be free from suffering. And there's only one way to be free from suffering, and that's to get off the cycle of samsara, to strike at the core of it, which, as we know, is desire, fear, aversion, and ignorance. That's the only way to get off the cycle of suffering. So a very useful guideline for this is provided by the First Noble Truth with its focus and its relentless enumeration of the different aspects of dukkha. One contemplates these. One contemplates all sentient beings are subject to old age, sickness, death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, despair. All the enumerations of the various forms of dukkha, the things that make life unsatisfactory, and realize every sentient being is subject to this. Every sentient being is subject to this. And we see that in ourselves. Once again, we start with ourselves, and we radiate a gentle feeling of compassion for ourselves. And then we radiate it out the same way to someone dear to us, then to our friends, our parents, our family, then to someone hostile. And then when we've achieved a high level of success with this, people who are suffering, we generate this compassion to people who are suffering. We can then move on to people who are presently enjoying happiness. But there's a proviso. We generate compassion by contemplating beings who are afflicted by happiness that they've acquired by immoral means. We develop compassion for people who are inflicted by happiness that they have acquired by immoral means, because we reflect that such people, despite their superficial fortune, are undoubtedly troubled deep within by the pangs of conscience. And even if they display no outward signs of inner distress, we know that they will eventually reap bitter fruits of their evil deeds, inevitably, and this will bring them intense suffering. So they get compassion. And finally, we can widen the scope of our contemplation to include all living beings. We radiate it outward. We contemplate all beings as subject to the universal suffering of samsara, driven by greed, aversion, and delusion through the round of repeated birth and death. And that's something people hang up on. You know, well, I don't believe in that rebirth thing. Well, we'll get into that. If compassion is initially difficult to arouse toward beings who are total strangers, it can be strengthened by reflecting that the Buddha's teachings, that in this beginningless cycle of rebirths, it's hard to find even a single being who has not been at some time one's own mother or father, sister or brother, son or daughter, and that is in the teachings of rebirth. The Dalai Lama used to be big on that. He'd say every being in the world used to be our mother, and that's how you radiate forgiveness and compassion and stuff. You just think that, you know, that guy that just kicked you in the groin used to be your mother in a previous life. It's a good exercise, if nothing else. So the summary of this is that there are three kinds of right intention: renunciation, goodwill, and harmlessness. And these counteract all the wrong intentions of desire, ill will, and harmfulness. And the importance of putting into practice these contemplations, which lead to the arising of unwholesome thoughts, can't be overemphasize, this is a very important part of the Eightfold Path. And these contemplations have been taught as methods for cultivation, not just theoretical exercises, you know, not something to debate and talk about and pick apart, but actual exercises. And if one were to describe the Buddha's teachings, not a religion, these are techniques and teachings to free the mind from the causes and conditions of suffering. And this is how I describe Buddhism. You know, people say, well, what's Buddhism about? You know, what's the basic premise? What are the beliefs? What's the religious beliefs? And I say, well, there are no religious beliefs. I said, the Buddha's teachings are teachings and techniques to liberate the mind from the causes of suffering. And that is how Buddha described it. He said, my teachings have one flavor, suffering, the origin of suffering, and the cessation of suffering. That's how Buddha himself described his goal. So Buddha assures us that victory can be achieved. He says, whatever you reflect upon frequently becomes the inclination of the mind. You know, basically, whatever you think about, that's where the mind goes. So if you frequently think sexual thoughts or hostile thoughts or harmful thoughts, that's where the mind goes. There'll be desire, ill will, and harm. That's where the mind will be inclined. But if you think in the opposite way, renunciation, goodwill, and harmlessness, that's where the mind will follow, like the cart follows the horse. So the direction we take will always come back to ourselves. The intentions we generate moment by moment in the course of our lives, or as it's taught in New Thought, internal states will manifest in reality. So we're going to talk about right speech, which is the next triad in this, is right speech, right action, and right livelihood. And this is the next division, which is the moral division. And we're going to talk about that in just a minute after our station identification.
You are listening to the LMC Radio Network, whose art and information may be found on its webcast shows. The LMC Radio Network is a community radio alliance of metaphysical, spiritual, inspirational, and political justice broadcasters spanning a wide range of topics. Tune in Sundays for the Lucky Mojo Hoodoo Rootwork Hour, hosted by Catherine Ironwood and Conjurman Ali. It features panel discussions on traditional African-American hoodoo spellcasting with members of the Association of Independent Readers and Rootworkers, plus free readings and magical rootwork advice for live call-in clients. The longest-running conjure show in the universe, it may be heard from 3 o'clock to 4:30 Pacific Time, Sunday afternoons. On Mondays, get ready for Candelo's Corner, starring Candelo Cambisa. This is the meeting place for all esoteric traditions. Candelo brings his insight as a Polero and eclectic spiritualist to his interviews with peers in Afro-Caribbean lineages, as well as representatives of numerous other spiritualities and religions. You can hear Candela's Corner Monday evenings from 5 to 7 Pacific Time. Tuesdays feature two wonderful shows to suit your taste. On the Crystal Silence League Hour, John St. Germain provides spiritual guidance and tips on the practical use of crystals and crystal balls. His show starts at 5 p.m. Pacific Time and lasts for 1 hour. Next is In the Streets with Beverly Smith. Beverly provides up-to-the-minute reports on civil and social rights issues. Her one-hour show airs on Tuesday evenings at 6 p.m. Pacific Time. On Wednesday nights, Kai Armand broadcasts On Sacred Ground, a tapestry of our times comprising history, ethnography, and shamanism, featuring the voices of the land and the deceased, aided by scholars, spirit workers, and environmentalists. Kai's show airs from 5 to 7 Pacific Time. On Thursdays, it's the Now You Know Show with Professor Porterfield. In a variety show laced with country wit and biblical wisdom, the professor shares his knowledge of roots, delivers the lucky numbers, and explores the secrets of scriptural sorcery. From 6 to 7:30 p.m. Pacific Time, there's no end to the surprises. And on Saturday nights, come out and join Liquid Libations. Andrea Weston hosts this informal sharing and showcasing of poetry, short stories, and spoken word performances contributed by novices and professional wordsmiths. Call in and read your work. Liquid Libations may be heard on Saturday nights from 5 to 7 p.m. Pacific Time. All shows on the LMC Radio Network are sponsored by the Lucky Mojo Curio Company, located in Forestville, California, and online at luckymojo.com. Add 3 hours for Eastern, tax and license may apply, train departure times and Burma shave signs subject to change without notice. LMC.
We're going to take a side road for a minute to discuss the mind, because the mind can't be purified if we don't thoroughly investigate it. So we're going to take a side road into the Abhidharma, which is advanced Buddhist psychology. This is actually Buddhism 303. And because it says in the Dhammapada, not to do evil, to cultivate good, to purify one's mind. This is the teaching of the Buddha. And the mind cannot be purified if we don't thoroughly investigate it. Penetrative investigation, remember, that was one of the big things. And when we try to analyze the mind, it seems to escape us. We can't grasp it. It said in Zen, the mind investigating the mind is like looking for an ox while riding an ox. I always love that. And the mind is variable. It changes very quickly. At one moment, there's a mind with attachment. At another, a mind with generosity. At another moment, a mind with anger. At each moment, there's a different mind. So in Buddhist teaching, we learn that in reality, the mind is different from what we mean by the word mind in conventional language. In other words, psychology has one meaning for mind, and Buddhism has another meaning for mind, and that's very important because you'll wind up fighting yourself. So in Buddhist teaching, we prefer to use, instead of the word mind, we use the Pali term citta, C-I-T-T-A, citta. Now, Pali is the language of the Buddhist scriptures. Of the Theravada tradition, which is the tradition I am most familiar with. Now, citta is derived from the Pali word for thinking. And all cittas have in common that they think of an object, but we have to take thinking in a very general sense, which means being conscious of an object, cognizing an object. Now, the Buddhist teachings explain in a very precise way the way the objects enter appropriate doorways. Can be cognized by citta. We covered this one time, but for example, color or visible objects can be known through the eye door, sound through the ear door, touch through the touch door, smell through the smell door. So through each of the senses, the corresponding object can be known. Through the mind door, all kinds of objects, and the mind is considered a sense. So there are six senses. So through the mind door, all kinds of objects, concepts and ideas can also be known. So, before you even study the Buddhist teachings, we have a vague idea of thinking mind, but we don't really have a precise knowledge of objects which are cognized through each of the appropriate doorways. This was something the Buddha really pioneered. So, citta is varied because of the different kinds of objects it experiences. Seeing is totally different from hearing. So you see, eye citta is different from ear citta. Now, citta is varied because of the different mental factors which accompany the citta. So there is a term, and this is important, cetasika, which are the factors that arise with each citta. And cetasika means belonging to the mind. There are 52 different cetasikas which have been categorized by Buddha and Buddhist scholars. 52 different cetasikas. These are mental formations that arise with every citta. Now, not all of them do arise. Now, there is only one citta at a time, which cognizes one object, and each citta or thought is accompanied by several cetasikas, which also experience the same object. Now, they perform their own function. This is not as complicated as it sounds. They arise and fall away with a citta. There is only one citta at a time. They can only be eye citta, ear citta, taste citta, but they happen so fast, sometimes they seem to be simultaneously. Now, citta and cetasika are mental phenomena, which is called nama, and they are real in the ultimate sense. There's ultimate and conventional realities. Ultimate realities have each their own characteristics, their own function, and they're true for everybody. Ultimate realities are true for everybody. And there are four ultimate realities. And in Buddhism, they're called paramatha dhammas. There are four ultimate dharmas: citta, cetasika, rupa, and nirvana. These are the four ultimate realities. These are true for everybody. Citta, cetasika, rupa, and nibbana. Citta, cetasika, and rupa are conditioned dharmas, which means they don't arise by themselves. They're conditioned by other phenomena. Citta doesn't arise by itself. It's conditioned by the accompanying cetasikas. Now, nirvana stands alone as the unconditioned dharma. It is the unconditioned dharma. It does not arise, and nirvana does not fall away. Nirvana is the object of a supramundane citta, which is called the lokottara citta, which is a type of citta that arises at the moment of enlightenment. Only Buddhas and enlightened people have this kind of citta, the lokottara citta. That is the enlightened mind. Now, this is exciting. I get excited with this kind of stuff. So what we call in conventional language a person, in the ultimate sense, is only citta, cetasika, and rupa. Rupa is the clay in which we live, the body. Rupa does not experience anything. Rupa is just clay. There is no lasting person or self. There are only citta, cetasika, and rupa, all of which arise and fall away immediately. Citta and cetasika are both namas. Citta and cetasika are realities which can experience something, whereas rupa does not experience anything. I hope this is clear. Citta and cetasika are what we call minds. Now, this is from the Abhidharma, which if you want to read this, get the comprehensive manual of Abhidharma and get your mind blown. This is 2,500 years ago. They knew this about the mind, and psychology today just now starting to dig this. But in order to explain the difference between citta and cetasika, in the very first book of the Abhidharma, there are similes, and they say it's like the king and his retinue. The king is the chief, and his retinue are his attendants. And this is how the cittas, which arise in our daily life, are the leaders in recognizing the object, and the cetasikas are the assistants of the citta. The cetasikas have to perform their own tasks and operate at each moment of citta. So the citta, with its accompanying cetasikas, arise each moment, and then they fall away immediately. So you may wonder, why do we worry about this? Well, these are very important. They're not abstract categories. They're active right now, this very moment, in every moment that we live. We could not see, hear, think, act, be angry, or have attachment without cetasikas. Seeing, for example, is a citta. Hearing is a citta. Taste is a citta. And it's the citta which recognizes color or visible object or sound. So in order to perform its function, it needs the assistance of cetasikas, such as contact, which contacts visible object or contacts sounds. Or another cetasika is one-pointedness, which focuses on the object. It's important to have understanding of this. We should know that defilements are also cetasikas, and that good qualities are cetasikas. Unwholesome qualities are cetasikas. And these arise in daily life, and when they appear, we should investigate their characteristics. Otherwise, we wouldn't know what's right and what's wrong. We wouldn't know when defilements arise and how deeply rooted they are. If the Buddha hadn't taught in detail about defilements, we would only have a vague idea about them. How would we see the danger of these defilements when they're unknown to us? And how could we know what's wholesome if we don't know the characteristics of wholesome cetasikas and the different ways of good deeds? There's a great variety of cetasikas. There's 52 of them, like a deck of cards. So unwholesome cittas are accompanied by cetasikas, which are defilements. And wholesome cittas are accompanied by cetasikas that are wholesome. So generosity is a wholesome citta that are accompanied by wholesome cetasikas. Anger is an unwholesome citta that are accompanied by wholesome cetasikas. For example, the cetasika wisdom can arise with the citta generosity. And when the citta with generosity, which is a cetasika, is accompanied by wisdom, which realizes that generosity is wholesome, the degree of wholesomeness is higher than in the case of wholesome cheetah without wisdom. So these are Chetasika's condition, the thought. So when there's generosity, understand, there's no person who's generous. Generosity is a Chetasika performing its function while it assists the wholesome citta. When there's attachment, there's no person who is attached. Attachment is a Chetasika performing its function. The Chetasikas which accompany the citta experience the same object as the citta, while they each perform their own function. At one moment, there can be attachment to color, which is experienced through the eye door. At another moment, there can be attachment to sound, which is experienced through the ear door. At another moment, there can be attachment to the concept of a person, which is an object experienced through the mind door. Citta and its accompanying Chetasikas arise and fall away extremely rapidly. When right understanding has not been developed, we cannot distinguish between different objects experienced through the different doorways. We're inclined to join different realities together into a whole, and we cannot realize their arising and falling away, their impermanence, and their nature of not-self. And that's why the study of Buddhism, there can be more understanding of the true nature of realities on this theoretical level, and then through development of direct understanding, we bring it to the real reality level and we'll know the truth through one's experience. The Abhidharma explains reality as seen through the enlightened mind, and we realize that there's no abiding ego or self who can direct the operations of the mind. There's a different citta all the time, and it's accompanied by different Chetasikas. That's all. They arise because of their own conditions. And we're so used to thinking in terms of a mind belonging to a human person, it's difficult to understand that there is no ego who can direct this mind, who can take his destiny or fate in his own hands and shape it. And if everything is beyond control, where's the human dignity? You know, that's the thought, right? So if one walks the Buddha's path, one begins to learn the difference between what is true in the ultimate sense and what's only imagination. And there'll be less delusion about the truth, and there eventually be an elimination of everything that's impure and unwholesome. And this is true freedom of mind. This is mental emancipation. And what higher good could anyone ever attain? So I want to tell you that to learn what types of Chetasikas can accompany which type of citta, and to learn all these different classifications can be cumbersome. But if you're into that kind of thing, it can really help you understand how your own mind works. But there's a cheetahs can be classified in a lot of different ways. One way is by their nature. There's a wholesome, unwholesome result, and then there's one called inoperative, which is neither cause nor result. And there's a whole lot of, and we'll get into this in the future when we start talking about them, and they perform different functions. Seeing is a function of citta, so seeing consciousness can do that. And then there's a thing called Patisandhi citta, which is rebirth consciousness. This attaches to the life continuum. And then there's Kuti citta, which is the dying consciousness. You see, the Bhavanga citta is what is the stream of consciousness that exists between cheetahs. This is what maintains your identity while you're asleep. So you see, this is stuff that's very interesting, and we'll pick it up next month and throughout. Wherever there's a sense impression, there's a citta, and there are several Chetasikas that arise with them. Now, there are cheetahs that arise without sense door process or mind door processes, and they perform functions too. And they are the rebirth consciousness, the dying consciousness, and the Bhavanga citta, which is what stores your personality. And we'll talk about these next week as we talk about moral training as well. So you see, we're starting to get into some heavy stuff here. People say, what is reborn? Well, the Bhavanga citta is what's reborn. And it's called storehouse consciousness in some studies. Not a soul, not an ego, not an identity. The Bhavanga citta is what connects one moment of consciousness to the other across lives. So see you next week, and do come back. And as always, I love you all. Mm-hmm.